call the meeting to order. This is the Conference Committee on Senate Bill 241. It's 8:02. Present, we have Senator Bishop, Senator Begich, Representative Kopp, Representative Sponholz, Representative Tallarico, and myself, Chair Coghill. The only order of business today will be Senate Bill 241, an act extending the March 11th, 2020 Governor's Declaration of Public Health and Disaster Emergency in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The Free Conference Committee on Senate Bill 241 will be operating under Uniform Rule 42 conference and Free Conference Committees, A, suspended. The uniform rules were waived and the Conference Committee has been granted the powers of Free Conference, which gives the Conference Committee the ability to consider all issues that are germane to the titles in the bill before the committee. Representative Kopp, you want to explain how we're going to manage this thing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I will explain the leadership as it applies to this committee. You, sir, Senator Coghill, will chair the committee as this bill originated as a Senate bill. I don't mention
that's it. Heavy on my shoulders. So the Free Conference Committee was granted because we have a House bill and a Senate bill that had new sections in it. And so the new sections had to be added to Senate Bill 241 to satisfy an agreement between the legislation. So that required a Free Conference, which makes everybody nervous. And so Representative Kopp, we have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Conference Committee adopt the proposed committee substitute 31-GS2260/G. as our working document.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. So we have two people to help us walk through this. We have Grace Irvine and Julie Lucky, who will be explaining this particular bill before us as we have it drafted at this point. Who wants to go first?
Mr. Chairman, I think Grace will explain the House.
Okay, Grace, you explain the House part.
Absolutely, thank you. For the record, Grace Irvine, staff to Representative Kopp in the House Rules Committee. I'm going to go through the changes that were made in the House to Senate Bill 241.
Okay,
instead of going section by section with numbers, not knowing which version you're all looking at, I'm just going to go by the titles of the sections, which should be clear. Throughout the...
Just for the information of those listening in, then we will switch over to Julie, who will walk us through a sectional. True, Julie?
Sorry, Chair Coghill. It might be easier if I start with a sectional and then if Grace wants to pop in with her the changes, because the first sections of the bill are actually the base bill from the governor's office.
Okay.
And so it might be a little bit easier to go
it
in
might
order.
Might be cleaner for us and those listening in to do that. And so, Grace, if it's okay with you, we'll just proceed that way.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Conference Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky. I'm staff to Senator Von Imhoff, but I'm on loan to the committee temporarily. I would like to start out by saying this was truly a collaborative effort. We started with 12 sections by the governor, added 9 House sections, and then today we added 7 Senate sections. So I would like to say we've been very collaborative, bicameral, bipartisan, and now we have a very large bill in front of us. So I will do my best to be clear about the sections that are in there. I do admit I am very familiar with the Senate sections. I will need a little bit of help from a lifeline for the governor sections, but I believe we do have someone online to help with that if there are questions about the underlying text.
For what it's worth, we do have, we have the Department of Law, Stacey Crayley on. We have Curtis Thayer from the Alaska Energy Authority. We have Lori Winghire, the Director of Insurance, Department of Commerce. And we have the Deputy Chief Administrative Law Judge, Cheryl Mandela. So, and then we do have representation from the governor's office here if we need to take any ease and figure something out. So please continue, Julie.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we'll start with sections 1 through 12 are all part of that original disaster declaration. Section 1 will be legislative findings. Section 2 is where you see the actual declaration for the disaster, and this is where you see the first change between the House and the Senate bill. The current date is November 15th, 2020, and that was added in the House. On Section 3, it outlines the disaster financing plan and where you will find all of the funds in the various appropriation bills that have come through the legislature to fund the disaster plan. Section 4 authorizes the chief medical officer to do standing orders, and I believe that there was a change in the House on that section as well.
Absolutely. Once again, Grace Irvin, for the record. There was a change in the House made to that section, the chief medical officer standing orders, Section 4. On the Senate floor, there had been an amendment that would allow the chief medical officer to establish standing orders related to retail seller sanitation. That section was removed in the House and then reordered within the bill. So it will reappear in a section yet to come.
Thank you, Grace.
Section 5 outlines reports to the legislature. It requires a monthly report starting in May 1st, and then it will culminate with a final report on January 15, 2021, or 60 days after the date the governor determines that the public health disaster emergency no longer exists. I believe there was no change in that. Okay. All right. And Section 6 allows professional and occupational licensing. It allows a little bit speedier professional and occupational licensing to deal with the professionals that we need to deal with the disaster, and that would be lifted when the disaster is lifted as well. I know that the committee is probably familiar with these base sections as they were very similar in both bills, so I will just quickly go through them, but if there's any questions, I'll be happy to answer what I can.
Thank you.
Section 7 deals with telemedicine and telehealth, and it relaxes some licensing requirements. It also states that the amount charged for telehealth must be reasonable and customary. It limits the fees, and it says they may not exceed 5% of the regular fee for the service.
And in the House, the definition of telehealth was expanded and clarified to utilize an existing statutory definition of telehealth found in AS 4705-270 subsection E.
Section 8 deals with fingerprinting, and it allows a more expedited service for fingerprinting. And Section 9 deals with elections, and it states the Division of Elections may conduct all elections in the same manner as an election by mail under AS 1520-800.
In the House, this vote-by-mail provision was expanded. When it came over from the Senate, the disaster sunset date was September 1st, 2020. In the House Rules Committee, we expanded that to be November 15th, 2020 as that sunset date. With that came an additional election, the statewide general election. This expanded the Division of Elections authority to in consultation with the Department of Health and Social Services, establish a vote-by-mail election for a primary, special, and statewide general election.
The way I understand it, committee, is it's still permissive to the Lieutenant Governor and the Division of Elections. Yeah, that's my own editorial. Thank you.
It's a make.
I know I'm getting shivers on that one, but all right, continue, please.
All right. Section 10 simply extends the permanent fund dividend application period to April 30th, 2020. Section 11 extends the tax deadlines to July 15th, 2020. Section 12 deals with how shareholder meetings can happen if people cannot get together. So it deals with telephonic and electronic shareholder meetings, and I believe this was changed in the House, and Grace, talk to this.
Grace.
Absolutely. Once again, Grace Irvin for the record. The bill as it came over dealt with shareholder meetings for for-profit corporations. The House expanded that to also allow for meetings to be conducted by telecommunications for nonprofits and similar provisions for village and native corporations.
And Mr. Chairman, so the next few sections are the House additions to the bill, and so I'd like to have Grace cover those.
Starting from section?
We're starting with section 13.
All right. Okay, Grace.
So section 13, once again, pardon me, Grace Irvin for the record. Section 13 deals with deadlines that pertain to municipal governments. This allows for deadlines that pertain to those municipal governments found in Title 29 to be expanded through the sunset of the disaster declaration allows municipalities a little bit more time. The next section, Section 14, creates a Alaska Regional Economic Assistance Program. Within the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, there is created the ability to make grants to organizations for distribution as financial assistance to small businesses. The next section deals with workers' compensation. It creates a presumption of compensability for workers, including firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, peace officers, or healthcare providers, aka our real front lines in the battle against this pandemic, who are exposed to COVID-19 and receive a positive diagnosis. So that's a presumption of compensability for those employees. Section 16 adds a new allowable absence for the permanent fund dividend. This adds to the current statutory list of allowable absences for the purposes of establishing residency requirements for a PFD, an absence based on an inability to return to Alaska due to voluntary or mandatory quarantine to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, Julie Lucky, I would like to point out here there was some concern about the drafting in this section. I just wanted to clarify for the record that I have talked to the drafter, and the intent of this section is to ensure that a person who is out of the state as of March 11th, on March 11th, before March 11th through March 11th, and then could not return to the state would also be included. There's a little bit of confusion because it says a period of time on March 11th, and I just wanted to clarify for the record that would include somebody who is out of state before March 11th as long as they were continuously out of state past that date.
Got it. All right.
Moving on to Section 17, we spoke about this briefly previously. This deals with the Department of Health and Social Services coordinating with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to establish sanitation procedures for retail sellers. The Department of Health and Social Services advised that this was a more appropriate place within the structure of the department to have these kind of sanitation procedures established. Once again, this is permissive also. There was a section within this bill that did come over from the other body that dealt with the cost of living allowance for presenters, retirees. This language was removed by the House after receiving reassurances from the Department of Administration that this was an action they were already taking for retirees who want to make their residency requirements to still really receive that cost of living allowance. They are proactively reaching out to retirees.
I remember correctly, Grace, that was also reassured on the Finance Committee as they were debating this very question, I think.
And Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Julie Lucky, I will affirm that that was offered as an amendment on the Senate Finance side and then withdrawn by the amendment sponsor after reassurances on the record by the department that these issues were already be taken care of.
Thank you.
The following sections, Section 18, relates to tolling deadlines for action by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the RCA. This suspends all statutory and regulatory deadlines for action by the RCA during the COVID-19 disaster emergency. The following section is a moratorium on disconnection of residential utility service. That's an institution of a moratorium on disconnection from utility services for residents.
Senator Biggs.
I just want to put something on the record in the spirit of my old boss and good friend Max Gruenberg. This in this section, it refers to statute on page 13, line 25, AS 4205990, to define public utility. Under public utility, number 8 in that definition is telecommunications, and it actually doesn't say the words internet services, but it's the intent that this would apply to internet services as well. And I just wanted to be clear that that was put on the record. Since it's not actually in the definition, we wanted to be clear that that was on the record.
Thank you. And Representative Spondels.
Moving back up to Section 18, one of the things I just wanted to clarify for the record as well is that we have been assured by the RCA that it's not their intention to use COVID-19 to sort of further delay in any way the Chugach Electric purchase of MLMP, and I think that's a very important thing to put on the record, that sale is very important to residents in Anchorage, and they have assured us that nothing that we're doing this bill is going to impede their ability to make progress on that.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, for the record, Julie Lucky, I would like to point out this bill does get a little bit redundant, and I wanted to, for the committee's edification, just explain a little bit of the drafting standard and why we had to do it this way. So you'll see this is the first time that this appears. In this section, we have a definition of financial hardship, which is starting, and we're on page 14, starting on line 20. And you will see this definition appear in each section where we talk about financial hardship. And the reason that has to appear so many times is that this is a temporary law. So instead of being put into a section of law, codified section of law, this is actually uncodified law. And so there's no actual statute number to refer to. So we couldn't just put in one definition and then refer back to that. And so I just want to assure the committee that the plan was to have financial hardship be exactly the same in each section. I have not yet had a chance to double check that, but I have been assured that was our aim, so hopefully that is the same in every section. And if I could just put that on the record now, Mr. Chairman, so that it's there for the rest of the bill, it means a person's liquid assets from any source, including payments from the state or federal government because of the COVID-19 public health disaster emergency or a state or national disaster declaration related to COVID-19, when combined, would be insufficient to pay the reasonable cost of food, housing, health care, and other goods and services vital to the health and wellness of the person and the spouse's person and dependents. And it goes on to state where the dependent definition comes from. And the reason I would like to point this out at this time, Mr. Chairman, is there was some concern that if people were getting a little bit of help, cash help from the government, we've heard that the federal government might be giving some wage replacement and some enhanced unemployment insurance payments, we do want them to pay their debts if they are getting some wage replacement in there. And so this statement says that if you are looking at your hardship, you also have to look at these payments when you're figuring out what your financial hardship level is.
Senator Begich, you had a point on that?
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think you may have got it, Julie. So the language is identical each time. It's intended to be identical each time, correct?
Senator Begich, through the chair, it is intended to be identical each time. I feel very confident working with our drafter that it is, but we did get this this revised CS just recently, and it was not in one of the sections, so I haven't had a chance to check this particular section, but the intent is that it is identical in each section.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, please continue. Section 20.
Section 20 touches on regulatory assets for unpaid utility bills and extraordinary expenses. This provides that a certificated utility may record regulatory assets to be recovered through future rates for uncollectible residential utility bills and extraordinary expenses that result during the period of time that the public health emergency disaster declaration for COVID-19 is in effect. And a determination as to whether an extraordinary expense resulted from COVID-19 and that amortization periods for the regulatory assets are subject to RCA approval before recovery through future rates, pardon me.
Which would go through a regular RCA process, which would be public testimony and declarations and various different process for that timeline, right?
Through the chair, absolutely. That is my understanding.
All right. Please continue.
And Section 21 is the last house change section, and this is a moratorium on evictions for non-payment. This provides a moratorium on evictions from rental properties and storage units containing personal belongings for non-payment of rent from March 11, 2020 to June 30, 2020 for a person experiencing a financial hardship under the definition that Julie just went through due to COVID-19. The statutory cause of action for forcible entry and detainer for non-payment of rent and any other statutory cause of action that could be used to evict or otherwise eject a person for non-payment is suspended for persons experiencing financial hardship during the disaster. A person seeking protection under this section shall provide a signed statement to the landlord stating that they are experiencing financial hardship. And this section clearly does not prevent evictions for misconduct, violations of law, or violations of contracts outside of the inability to pay rent, nor can it be construed as an increase to civil liability in a court of law.
So just for myself, it's a hardship related to the COVID-19, just to make sure, Senator.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to reaffirm we all have received a lot of contact from folks that were worried that it might be a, you know, free-for-all, I won't pay my rent thing, and that's not the intent at all. It really is to look out for the interests of those who are truly suffering hardship and to make sure that that fair relationship between landlord and tenant is maintained in a respectful and a way that's respectful of these times of crisis.
Senator Bishop.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also like just to point out that the storage unit was added at the Senate's finance table by Senator Olson, and also along the lines on the emails that we're getting today, there's a lot of things moving fast. People from afar are watching us, and I was on the phone with the court system today. The courts are not hearing evictions through May 1, so just want to put that on the record.
Representative Kopp, I will promote everybody to senator tonight. Careful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did all receive many emails from landlords, and I really wanted to make it very clear that if someone is a bad actor, if they're violating the law or they're violating their rental contract, this gives them absolutely no protection, and a landlord can proceed forward with eviction just as they would at any other time. This only deals purely with inability to pay directly because of COVID-19. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Spunholz.
Thank you. Representative Kopp said much of what I was going to say. I think it's really important that the public understand that there's a lot of sideboards on this. It's also important to understand this does not waive anybody of the responsibility to pay their rent, that in fact they have a responsibility to pay their rent. If they're for some reason not able to pay their rent because of COVID-19 in a temporary way, they'll still accrue the liability. But what this does is ensure that we're not increasing our homeless problem at the same time as we're having a COVID-19 crisis, since we wanted to make sure that we weren't sort of exacerbating, creating additional problems that we would all have to compensate for as well. Thank you.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's also important to put on the record and point out that this is a very significant penalty if this is not abided by, and that we would want people to know and put on the record that the penalty of perjury, I do believe, I'm not an expert, but I believe it's Class B felony, and I believe that's up to 10 years and up to a $100,000 fine could be associated with that. So that's also important to have on the record as well. People certainly would need to be aware of that.
This is one of the places where the financial hardship comes into play again, and that language is the same, and that is if they're getting federal help, that will count as part of their income, so they can't say, I don't have any money if they get in the federal help, basically, right? Am I correct on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Please continue. I might point out just, and I think that the panel, the committee did it for me, but I do want to point out that there were some changes in the way that the bills were constructed, and when we went through, when we were doing the conference CS, anything that seemed unclear, we tried to make it very clear, because it is going to be people who are already suffering hardship that are going to be reading through these sections. So a few of the things you'll see is that each of the sections very clearly states that a statement must be made under penalty of perjury. It very clearly states what that financial hardship definition is. It very clearly states the financial hardship must be due to the COVID virus, and it also clearly states that it does not absolve a person of their debt. It just makes it so that things, they cannot be evicted, or items cannot be taken from them, or they cannot lose their car. Those are, and I'll go through those sections as we go through, but each of the sections will have that similar redundant language in it, just to be very clear. Another thing that we did with the statutory construction is just make sure that the date is in each section. Often laws have repealers, and this does have a repealer section, but it was important to clarify, since people will be looking at this to help with their hardships, what date each of these sections went through. And so that is a little bit of a different statutory construction than some of them had in it, and that it does have a date certain now in each section. And so this date would be, for the evictions, would be June 30th, 2020 is the end date for that moratorium.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Okay, and so the rest of the section are Senate sections. I hope I can do as well as Grace did on explaining these. Section 22, states the income determinations for public assistance. The intent of this section is to ensure that as money is coming in to help people deal with the economic impacts of the mandated closures and mandated school closures and the inability to travel and go to work, that if there is any aid coming from either the state or federal government, that isn't going to take them off of any public assistance they are currently able to get. So each of these are what is colloquially called hold harmless. So you'll see that for various sections of public assistance and Medicaid to ensure that if they're getting additional funds, that that does not kick them off of those the rules for public assistance. Okay, section 23 is forbearance of state loans. So very similar to a moratorium on evictions, this would state that for state loans, they cannot be found in default and the state cannot take any collateral for those loans. And this would go until the emergency no longer exists or until November 15th, 2020, whichever is earlier. It does have the same process where the borrower must have a signed statement, and then it also has the same statement that they would still owe the obligation. They just couldn't be found in default or have their collateral taken from them.
And the financial hardship definition is in there?
Yes, sir. Under the state loans, there were some specific go through here. So if you go to page 18, the definition of state, it's starting on line 9, so it specifically calls out the State of Alaska programs, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, and the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, and it specifically exempts the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and the Department of Revenue Treasury Division. And the what this section was trying to get at is if people have boats or they have revolving loans where they have set up some collateral or they have student loans, we did not want them to lose their good credit. We did not want them to lose their boats or their permits. But for the agencies that use loans more as an investment asset, we wanted to exempt them to allow them to the best of their ability to continue to do that, and that's why the particular exemptions were called out as those. It's my understanding are entities that do not give loans to actual individuals with collateral that would be harmed, and that was the intent of the section, was to protect the individuals from having their
And we had some discussion around this, Julie. Alaska Housing does both, and so we'll see something that come up on that when we get to amendments, but that was a discussion as we were going through this. We found out that Alaska Housing does the individual loans, and then they do asset-based money transfers as loans. So we'll see that come up as well. So this is a good section to remind ourselves of that.
Section 24 is, it'll be very similar. This is similar to evictions. There is a moratorium on foreclosures. It has the same date through June 30th, 2020. And it just puts a moratorium on the ability for a property to be disclosed on or foreclosed on. I'm sorry. Again, it does not relieve the person of their obligation to pay the debt. I did want to point out a couple of items in here that the section does not apply to real property that is vacant or abandoned. And it also, on page 19, line 10, talks about that the person means a natural person. So this would be a personal dwelling or owned by a person, not a corporation. I just want to put that on the record. There was some discussion about whether the moratorium should apply to businesses, but the moratorium is very, it's written to just apply to natural persons. Okay, here's where I'm a little bit out of my depth because, well, I might play a lawyer on TV. I'm not actually a lawyer, so hopefully there aren't too many questions on this section. Section 23 allows a will to be witnessed by video conference, and I believe...
Mr. Chairman, Section 25.
Oh, I'm sorry, Section 25. I'm sorry. It says Section 25. I just did not see that correctly. I know that this was an issue that I believe was first discussed on the Senate floor, and then there were some concerns about that language in the House. It was worked on by the sponsor with the department and some other entities, and we believe that the language that came through in this amendment, which was offered in the Senate Finance Committee and has been incorporated to a different bill and has been incorporated here, does what it wants to do, which is allow witnessing of a will by video conference. It is a temporary act. And the person who is the witness does have to, within 60 days, sign and attach the will or an exact facsimile of the will with a statement for the witnessing. So it does allow witnessing by video conference, but then a follow-up written declaration from the person who was the witness.
Senator Biggish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to take a moment to thank the work in particular of Suzanne Cunningham, who's in the room, who helped massage attitudes about this and ensure that we got a good Department of Law piece of language that could satisfy everybody. So I want to just do the shout out and thank you for the coordination because it kept us moving forward.
As well as Representative Klayman, who put a lot of effort into this.
Of course. Sorry about that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll try to keep my numbers straight this time. Section 26 outlaws unfair or deceptive trade practices. This provision would be in place for the entirety of the disaster declaration, and it says that a person that charges more than 10% over the price charged for supplies in the normal course of business before the start of the coronavirus disease. So it basically keeps a lid on prices and make sure they can't go up too much during the time of the declaration. 10% is the threshold. It does have an exception for if there's an increased cost to the seller. So if the supplies cost more, 10% or more to buy, then of course there can be a commensurate increase when they sell them. But other than the rising prices for the wholesale price, they would not be able to go more than 10%. And then there's definitions of supplies that starts on page 20, line 22, and it includes food, medicine, medical equipment, fuel, sanitation products, hygiene products, essential household supplies, and other essential goods.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about that fuel along the way here before we get out of here.
Section 27, probably by now this language is looking very familiar, is a moratorium on repossession of motor vehicles. So it does have the same provisions that have been in the other sections, requiring the person seeking protection to have the statement under a sworn penalty of perjury, that does not relieve the person of the obligation to pay the debt, the financial hardship definition, and it specifies that the person must be experiencing a financial hardship related to the COVID-19 public health disaster emergency. This provision would end on June 30th, 2020. It does apply to motor vehicles, aircraft, or watercraft, and those have definitions already in statute. Okay, Section 28 is a statement that I think everybody should like. It allows us to receive more federal money. So what it does is it says the governor shall apply to the United States Department of Education for any emergency funding, and then provide assurances, make all reasonable efforts to provide assurances required for the state to receive the maximum federal funding. And while we don't have a specific fiscal note for this because we're not sure exactly how much is coming, I've heard it, give me just a minute, I had that right here, there we go. It's estimated to be up to, I believe it's $8,700,000, if I can read my points right on this fiscal note. We will not be adopting that fiscal note because of the way the federal funding is coming, and we're not sure exactly how much that is, but this was provided for informational purposes, and that will be for some additional educational funding that might be available through the CARES Act being considered in Congress. Section 29 simply states that the Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development is encouraged to issue an RFP for Alaska seafood that could be used in food banks and soup kitchens in the state. It is our understanding from discussion at the Senate Finance table that there is some seafood that is not being utilized because of all of the closures at this time. So it seemed like a good idea that if we had seafood sitting around and people who were hungry, that DCCED should consider putting out an RFP to purchase that and provide that.
Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to say Senator Wilson offered this in committee and was fully supported. Food security is we're really seeing how important food security is now, and this is just another arrow in our quiver to solidify that food security for the people of Alaska. Thank you.
Good point. All right.
Section 30 relates to financial assistance to address homelessness. We did hear during some of our committee hearings in the Senate Finance Committee, and I believe the House Finance Committee had some as well, that AHSC does have programs available to help keep people from becoming homeless. And this particular language would just expand that for homelessness that is the result of a health disaster emergency. We're concerned about, although we do have the eviction moratorium and the foreclosure moratoriums, this would just provide an additional safety net. This comes along with, I believe, a $5 million fiscal note. It's one of the only fiscal notes to add more to that grant program in order for them to meet this higher demand. And you will notice that the language does say subject to appropriation, so we're not asking them to spend any of the money that they have earmarked for other things. We are providing them additional money to do this additional task.
Okay.
And Section 31, tolling of the Office of Administrative Hearing Deadlines. This was very similar to the House has a section regarding to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And so we had checked with the executive branch to see if there were any hearings that might need the same sort of protection. The intent of this section is that if you have a hearing and there's a statutory or regulatory deadline, and missing that deadline would either be an approval or a denial for something automatically. Some of the things are set up that if a hearing doesn't happen in a certain number of days, it's an automatic denial. If there were some effects of the COVID-19 mandates where maybe they couldn't have a meeting in time or the work couldn't get done, they didn't have enough staff, this is to provide protection so that would not be an automatic denial or approval. So this provision will be in place for the duration of the emergency declaration and 30 days thereafter, so that on the day that the declaration isn't lifting, they're not having to do the point is that they will have 30 days to timely go through all of these hearings, but there was concern that given unlimited time that it might just slow down all the hearings, so that's why there's a 30-day kind of grace period. I would like to note in this section that it does not apply to a statutory or regulatory deadline occurring before the disaster declaration on March 1st, and it also would not apply to a deadline under 4464060 related to a matter referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings by Department of Revenue or the Department of Health and Social Services, or a deadline for acting on a summary suspension of a facility or occupational license. These were some concerns about some of the committee members, and so we did put some sideboards on here to make everybody comfortable with the types of hearings that would be told.
For example, if you have a healthcare official who is under some kind of a sanction, they would continue doing that sanction, is what you're saying.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So these were seen as possibly safety risks to not have these license suspensions and facility suspensions. The other statement that's in this is under subsection D, which is on page 23, line 17, that the Office of Administrative Hearings shall continue to make reasonable efforts to take action and issue decisions as soon as possible. So if they are able to, it is our firm expectation that they won't keep people waiting and they will continue having these hearings. But what the Senate Finance Committee was concerned about was if there were these statutory deadlines and they were missed despite best efforts, that they did not want appeals to be denied or approved just by virtue of not having the hearing.
If I remember correctly, as we went through this, we also talked to the Office of Administrative Hearings to make sure that this language did work for them. And the one cleanup language they had was on line four, requesting five, I'm sorry, the decision maker to be the final decision maker on the matter. It wasn't necessarily going to be the Office of Administrative Hearings, but the actual decision maker, which may be a bureaucratic office. So I think we went through that. Question, Representative?
I have a question on an earlier topic.
Okay. All right. So finish out this, and we'll go to an earlier topic. We'll back up.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to put on the record that this language was vetted by the Office of Administrative Hearings and approved by them. So you are correct that we have been working closely with them to make sure that our intent was to make sure that we put in statutory authority that would make it easier and not more difficult. So this language has been thoroughly vetted. And that concludes the Senate adds, the rest of the language is the transition and effective
date. Before we get to
the
transition, let's let Representative Sponholz back up a little bit to a further question, or previous question. Representative?
Thank you, Chair. So moving back up to Section 14, I think in an earlier version of this bill, when I looked at the definition of, this is the Regional Economic Assistance Program, I think in an earlier version of this, and I don't know, remember if it was in a CS or an amendment form that I looked at this, the definition of organization included nonprofit organizations. When I just checked this, this looks like it's referencing regional economic assistance programs, and I just wanted to see if we had anybody that could help us with that definition. I think it was my understanding that the intent wasn't necessarily that the money only went to regional economic development organizations, but that it could be distributed to nonprofit organizations across the state that are doing work to prevent hardship. So do we have anybody that can help us with that?
Who would that be? I don't think so. Grace?
Representative Sponholz, through the chair, I'm just looking at the House CS for 241 rules amended House. So this is the version that passed the House, and I'm looking at the definitions of organization in the section organization as the meaning given in AS 4433896, and I'm seeing that that does match up to the version that was passed out of the House. But if you give me a minute, I can refer to the floor amendment as well.
Did you have something on that, Senator Bishop?
Just on that point, there's so much stuff moving around, and I was looking in the federal package, and there's $358 billion in the SBA that's coming our way for nonprofit survey, I think, are included as well inside that as on the federal side.
I may also be conflating these two issues, because I think that my memory is that we were working on we worked on an amendment on the House floor to make sure that we would be able to receive, we would have essentially the shell to receive the SBA money that would be able to funnel out to organizations across the state. And I just want to make sure that we have the needed flexibility here to do this. And I'm not as familiar with the regional economic organizations as maybe some other members of the committee are, but I want to make sure that we have the right structure in here. And if we need to add in a different definition of organization to supplement this, apologize for throwing a little bit of a fly in the ointment here, but I think it's important that we get this piece right, because we're talking about a lot of money funneling through, and we want to make sure it gets to where it needs to go.
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, once again, Grace Irvin for the record. I am now looking at the House floor amendment, and it does have the same definition of organization given in AS 4433896.
Okay, thanks.
So it'll be the Department of Commerce and Community Economic Development that will work through these grants. If you look on, so even though it's the economic assistance program through the regional groups, DCED is going to be the one that does the making and distribution of those grants.
And those funds, those grants then will go to the regional development organizations, right, that will spend the money then?
Yep.
All right. Thanks.
So there will be accountability. Yeah. So whatever degree of accountability we're going to have in the next few months. All right, so we were in the remaining sections, Julie. Transition?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So I'm not sure how much detail we want to get into the transition sections, but I'm happy to go through very briefly what they
explain
do.
Explain kind of why we have to do these, and you're right, it can get pretty arcane, but give us the high level of the kind of the gears that have to mesh.
So, Mr. Chairman, the transition regulation section, it just allows the Commissioner of the Health and Social Services to adopt regulations to implement Section 22, which is the hold harmless provisions we had talked about earlier, and the Commissioner of Administration to adopt regulations necessary to implement Section 23, which I had in my handy-dandy notes earlier, but when we changed sections. Oh, for the forbearance for state loans, because that would be a state loan program, so they would have to adopt temporary regulations to allow that forbearance. And then we had sections, and I tried to go through all the sections as we went through and say which ones were applicable when, but the rest of them are, Section 33 is a repealer date, and it's for the most of the disaster declaration sections, and then those two sections I just mentioned, which have to do with the hold harmless sections and the Section 23, and then Section 30, which I believe is the wills attestation. Let me double financial assistance to address homelessness. So those provisions are all repealed on either November 15, 2020, which is the end of the declaration, or the date the governor lifts the declaration if that should happen prior to November 15, 2020. And I apologize, I had made the notes in my previous version, but I can get to this really quickly. Section 34 deals with the reports to the legislature, so that is repealed on January 16, 2021, the day after the last report is due. Sections 21, 24, and 27 are repealed June 30th, and those were the provisions regarding, I just want to make sure I get it right for the record, so if I could just have just a minute to look through my notes. The moratorium on evictions for non-payment, which ends on June 30th. The
moratorium on foreclosures.
There's the foreclosures and repossession of vehicles, right?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Seem to have lost the last page of my sectional there. and then I guess I might have to have you do the rest of the sections. I seem to have lost my sectional. There are some sections repealed on March 11th, and those are the ones that lasted a little bit longer than the declaration. And so that would be
Section 21, moratorium on evictions for non-payment.
Oh, no, that's section. So we're here on
25, 26, 28, 29, 30.
So the witnessing of will by video conference, that actually lasted a month past the declaration. So just as a clarification, the section, if there is a date in the section, that is when the provision will actually no longer be effective. The repeal basically takes the words out of the statute book, basically. So if there are dates in conflict, it is the date in the section of law that would actually be when the program ends. And then we had just put a longer repeal date on the all of the provisions that were a little bit longer. So the wills, I believe, goes through a month after the declaration. The unfair deceptive trade practices, I'm unsure why this was actually in the longer section. That was the drafter had recommended. And I will say that I'm unsure why these all got into the longer section. These were the things that the drafter had determined should be in the longer section based on provisions that they had. So that would be Section 25, witnessing of wills, Section 26, unfair deceptive trade practices, Section 28, which is the state access to federal education stabilization funds. That one I know because we want to make sure we're able to accept the funds as long as possible. Section 29, purchase of seafood for distribution, and Section 31, I was missing off my sectional, which I believe is Office of Administrative Hearings, because they're allowed a month after the declaration is lifted in order to finish up those last hearings. The regulations are annulled on March 11, 2021. And then there's an uncodified law to allow for retroactivity, and that is based on when we, just in case the bill did not pass on time, this would be retroactive then till the various dates, certain sections till April 10th, and then certain sections through March 11th, and then an immediate effective date for the bill. And that concludes the sectional. I would like to, at this time, Mr. Chairman, if I could put just a couple of things on the record.
Sure.
For the economic mitigation package, that when we had discussed it at the table at Senate Finance, it was our intent, it was the committee's intent, to put in some unemployment insurance or wage recovery. And what we found out through our efforts with Senator Bishop as well as other members of the committee is that if we actually put something into state statute, it might jeopardize the funding that would be coming down from the federal government. And I just wanted to put on the record that our expectation is that the federal government will, we have our caps for the unemployment insurance. It is our understanding that they will be sending additional funds to provide $600 per week for those who are on unemployment insurance. In addition, they are providing the same benefits to people who actually do not pay into unemployment insurance, which members have been calling the gig economy, so they will get a commensurate payment. And what we are told by our Unemployment Insurance Department of Labor representatives is that the way that the federal law works, when the federal law comes down, they have to comply with that right away, and that if we put in state provisions that were contrary, that might actually conflict with what they were trying to do, and also the timing, the way the timing would work, they would have to do the federal programming first. It was our intent to put in a little bit of a bridge funding. So while they were waiting for these benefits to come on, at least they would be getting something. But we were told that they will start right away programming to put in those federal dollars, and therefore the state dollar program wouldn't even be programmed until that the federal program was in place. And I believe Senator Bishop does have details if the committee has more concerns, but that is just one plank that was missing that we had intended to put in, but we learned that it was better for the federal benefit was better.
Thank you, Julie. Senator Begich?
Just related, you just mentioned in Section 25 that that the on line 16 that the wills would be extended for 30 days thereafter, but the document actually says 10 days. I just wanted to point that out. So, and I think we're fine with 10 days, but I just wanted to be sure that you saw that this is the language we all agreed to. So,
okay.
Just for that record piece. And if I may, you know, there was the question about the nonprofit earlier related to Section 14, if I may.
Sure.
So there's, I just want to be clear, people understand, in nonprofit, this section, if you look at line 19 in this section, organization is
what,
the meaning.
What page in line?
Oh, I'm sorry, line, page 11, line 19. Just to be clear of what the definition means. In this section, organization has the meaning given in AS 4433896. And I just, if I may read the definition
so
we have
it
on the record. Organization means a nonprofit organization or nonprofit corporation formed to encourage economic development within a particular region of the state that includes the entire area of each municipality within that region and that has a board of directors that represents the region's economic, political, and social interests. So it's a fairly broad definition that does include nonprofit entities, and I wanted to be clear because you were asking a question, Representative Sponholz, about whether nonprofits were or weren't included, I think. And I think it's implicit in the definition because it refers directly to this statute, and that is listed in 4433896, section 1, make sure I get this right, don't want to mess it up. Looks like section 5, subsection F, subsection 2. I think I got that right, but that is in 4433896, a definition of organization. So.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think I read that statute on the House floor the other day and sort of ticked the box off and moved on. But when I looked at it again, I was sort of skimming it during committee. And so I didn't see it all the way. And I really appreciate your putting that on the record. I think it's really important that nonprofits are incredibly efficient ways of making sure that we get funds into communities and that we do that, you know, inexpensively in a quick way and that we use that resource that we have at the ready. So thank you, Senator Begich.
We also have some fiscal notes. Do you want to run through the fiscal notes at this point, or?
So, Mr. Chairman, we do have some fiscal notes. I believe we have, if I counted them correctly, we have roughly 22 fiscal notes. So what I would like to do is
Tell us how many are indeterminate and how many actually got numbers on them.
So we'll try to get the painful part done very quickly. So what I'll do is I've grouped, they will not be going through, I will not be going through them in numerical order. I have grouped them for what we have fiscal notes that have money, fiscal notes that are indeterminate, and then what we call the 00 ends, which means they are all zero and there are no regulations required. So I will just list those when I get to the end, but we'll start with the fiscal note. It's fiscal note number, I believe it's 27 in your packet, and it is a new fiscal note for this CS. It is. The department affected will be Department of Revenue. Appropriation is the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The allocation is AHFC operations. The OMB component number is 3048. And it looks like a zero until I circled it for you until you get to the bottom and you'll see that supplemental appropriation. And so that's that $5 million that I was talking about to give those grants to homelessness. So there's no operation cost, but we are giving them an additional $5 million for grants with this fiscal note. The next fiscal note I'll cover is fiscal note 24. This is luckily the only other one that has numbers on it. So this one comes from, this is an existing fiscal note, 24. The department is Department of Revenue. Appropriation is Taxation and Treasury. The allocation is the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. OMB component is 981. And there's an estimated supplemental cost of 7.2 thousand. And I believe that is because we are changing our filings. We're extending the filing season until April 30th, 2020. So they need some programming for their database to make sure that they can accept that. And those are the only, I don't know if there's any questions about it. Those are the only two notes with, out of all of the notes, those are the only two with money in them. So the next one I'd like to go over is number 23. And I'm sorry that I'm going out of order, but this will put all the zeros at the back. This actually is a zero fiscal note, but I do want to point out that there, if you look at the bottom, associated regulations, there will be some regulation changes adopted by the agency. So that's fiscal note number 23, which is zeros, but they do need some, they do need to promulgate some regulations, emergency regulations to implement the mail voting at a statewide level, and we did talk about that in the bill presentation. The next few are indeterminate notes, and so the reason these are indeterminate is they feel that they will have a fiscal impact, but they're unsure exactly how much that will be. Our first one will be fiscal note number 5. The department will be Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Appropriation is Military and Veterans Affairs. Allocation is Office of the Commissioner. OMB component is 414, and it is an indeterminate for appropriation. So they know that they will probably need to spend some money, but they weren't sure exactly how much, so they just wanted to put that on the record. The next department is Department of Administration, Appropriation, Risk Management. Allocation is Risk Management, and is similar, it is an indeterminate appropriation requested. Not sure if I can answer questions about their fiscal notes, but the next two are indeterminates, but this is what they call an indeterminate change in revenue. So these will be because they think that they'll be getting less money. Not that they don't know what they'll be spending. They do have zeros for appropriations, but they think that they'll be getting less money in for their revenues. So the first one would be Department of Labor and Workforce Development appropriation.
Is there a number on
it? Oh, I'm sorry. This would be a new one, so I believe it's number 28. And the component number is 344. That's right. Apologies, Senator Begich. Mine actually didn't have the numbers on them, so I have to refer back to this form. So department would be Department of Labor and Workforce Development, appropriation workers' compensation, allocation is workers' compensation. The OMB component number is 344, and they do have an indeterminate change in revenue. This is a new one, and it is due to the House Floor Amendment number 5, which amends uncodified law to establish the presumption of certain categories of emergency response employees and providers where a COVID-19 infection resulted from employment when certain conditions are met. So this is that presumptive
presumption of compensability.
Okay, and then the next one is, I believe it's fiscal note number 29. It's OMB component number 1234. So the department would be Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Appropriation is ADA. Allocation is ADA. OMB component number again is 1234. And they have an indeterminate change in revenues for their ADA receipts. And I believe that is due to the prohibition that SB 241 prohibits the state as a lender to find a borrower in default, ask a court or arbitrator to find a borrower in default, or seize or otherwise obtain collateral from a borrower. And so this is just to reflect that ADA as a state lender would be unable to find a borrower in default or obtain collateral. And so they cannot predict the fiscal impact this legislation may have on revolving fund loan fund balances, but if ADA cannot foreclose on debts, it could potentially result in the loss of an amount in excess of, is that 100 million?
Yeah.
That's a lot of zeros there. 100 million. Yeah. And but long-term implications are not determined at this time. So on the plus side, that is all of what we call the money notes. So the rest of them are zeros. So what I will do is just briefly go through and say the departments and the component numbers just so we know who we're affecting, but we're not, it's not actually causing them any financial implications. And these are will be in numerical order as much as I can. So the first one is fiscal note number 1. Department is Office of the Governor. Appropriation is Executive Operations. Allocation is the Executive Office. OMB component number 6. The next is fiscal note number 6. The department is Department of Public Safety. Appropriation is statewide support. Allocation, Criminal Justice Information Systems Program, OMB component number 3200. The next one somehow was left out of my packet, and I'll see if I can find it. Do you have fiscal note 11? There we go, fiscal note 11. So the department will be Department of Revenue, appropriation is taxation and treasury, allocation is the tax division, OMB component is number 2476. The next one will be fiscal note number 18, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, appropriation is Community and Regional Affairs, allocation is also Community and Regional Affairs, OMB component number 2879. The next fiscal note, zero fiscal note, is fiscal note number 20. Department is the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Appropriation is insurance operations. Allocation is insurance operations. OMB component number 354. The next fiscal note is number 21. Department is Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Appropriation is the Alaska Energy Authority. The allocation is the Alaska Energy Authority Power Cost Equalization. OMB component number 2602. Fiscal note number 22, Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Appropriation is Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Allocation is Regulatory Commission of Alaska. OMB component number 2417. And since I had mine out of order, I will. The next one should be number 26. Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
23.
Do you have 20? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Since mine were, I had mine before they were numbered, I'm unsure. Let me just grab a packet.
Yeah, we have number 23, the elections.
Number 23 is Office of the Governor. Appropriation is elections. Allocation is elections. OMB component number 21. Okay, and we had already gone over number 24. Okay. Number 25, Department of Health and Social Services. Appropriation is public health. Allocation is emergency programs. And OMB component is number 2877. The next one will be 26. Department is Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Appropriation is investments. Allocation is investments. And the OMB component number is 383. 27 we already reviewed. Number 28 was already reviewed. So the next zero is fiscal note number 30. Department is Health and Social Services. The appropriation is public assistance. The allocation is public assistant field services. And the OMB component is number 236. Go through fiscal note number 31. Department is the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. The appropriation is the Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. Allocation is Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And the OMB component number is 2360. Okay. Fiscal note number 32. Department is Department of Administration. Appropriation is the Centralized Administrative Services. Allocation is the Office of Administrative Hearings. OMB component number 2771. Fiscal note number 33, department is the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Appropriation is banking and securities. The allocation is banking and securities. OMB component number 2808. Fiscal note number 34. Department is the Department of Education Early Development. The appropriation is the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. The allocation is Program Administration and Operations. OMB component number 2738. All right, we're getting to the end. Fiscal note number 35. Department is Department of Law. The appropriation is the Civil Division. The allocation is the Deputy Attorney General's Office. OMB component number 2205. And I believe this is our last one.
Oh, we have two more, I think.
Oh, we have two more? Okay. Fiscal note number 36. The department is the Department of Health and Social Services. The appropriation is Medicaid services. Allocation is Medicaid services. And the OMB component number is 3234. Senator.
So, and Reneva tells me this may be a duplicate?
Yes, I think I went over 11. I knew that I was missing that one, so I had gone over that one in numerical order with the zero. So that concludes all of the zero fiscal notes. I appreciate the committee's patience while we went through all of that boring numbers business.
Well, it's important people know that we're examining, number one, what dollars and what we're actually going to expect of agencies. So I have maintained an objection to adopting the committee substitute. I'm going to remove my objection. Is there further objection to adopting this as our working draft? Having none, we do have some amendments. Who wants to put the first amendment up?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment E1.
E.1, we'll call that amendment number one. I'll object so you can describe it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I refer members to page 20, line 19. This is a conceptual amendment because it's not quite been drafted to this version, but to a previous version. So page 20, line 19. What this amendment does is it recognizes that the items called out for possible price gouging under the unfair or deceptive trade practices. Of those items, most of them are very stable price items. You would have to have pretty significant market factors change their price, whereas fuel is a commodity which tends to be more volatile with the market. And what this does is, if you look at line 19, where it has a qualifier that you cannot be considered to have committed an unfair trade practice under the Consumer Protection Act. If you're charged, it says unless if a person charges more than 10% more than the normal course of business market would be before the coronavirus, unless your 10% increase caused by the increased cost was for the seller to purchase the supplies, and the amendment continues, or for a person in the business of selling fuel caused by normal fluctuations in the market for fuel based on supply and demand. And possible scenario, Mr. Chairman, would be if Saudi Arabia and Russia came to agreement on their ability to moderate pushing oil into the market, and the price of oil then raised from $20-some a barrel to $40-some a barrel in a week, that would be a normal market fluctuation as a result of them deciding to stabilize the economy or the oil price environment, and recognizing that the whole chain from the refineries all the way down would experience a market shift. And it just recognizes of food, medicine, medical equipment, sanitary products, hygiene products, fuel is in a different category. It acts more like a commodity in the market. And it gives those people in that business clear understanding that we recognize that normal market fluctuations may fall outside of the normal guidance in this.
Yeah, because
and for the record, I did go over with the member who offered this amendment originally, and he was fully supportive of it. So.
Senator Begich?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just, you know, this, I'm supportive of this because my member is also supportive of this, but I just want to make sure that we are cautious in how this is applied. This has been a case that's been litigated. Cases similar to this have been litigated in the past. This is not the time for Alaskan owners of businesses to take advantage of those who are disadvantaged. And so I'll be keeping a close eye on how prices fluctuate when it comes to this. And I will be returning to this body, to our body, to talk about and to seek redress if, in fact, there are sellers who do take advantage of this crisis to hurt consumers. But with that said, I do support. My member has said that they have, in the interest of moving forward, this is fine amendment, and that they would be supportive of it, with that caveat that we should be watching very closely. It's our job to do so.
I know I don't have to remind anybody here, but when we came to Juneau, it was the price of a barrel of oil was around the $60-$65 mark, and now it's around the $20-$25 mark. So it's a commodity that fluctuates wildly, but it is true that people can game the fluctuation. There's no doubt about it. Representative Sponholz.
Yeah, I'm going to support this amendment, but I do want to note that we oftentimes see in Alaska that while the price of fuel on the international market will drop, we don't always see a commensurate drop at the gas station or at the fuel pump. And so, I'll be supporting this today, and I also will be keeping an eye on it to make sure that Alaskans are going to be well protected. Thank you.
I'll remove my objection. Any other objection to this amendment? With that, the amendment is adopted, and we'll go to the next amendment. Representative Sponholz.
I'd like to move conceptual amendment number E2.
E2, we'll call that amendment number 2, and I'll object.
All right, thank you. So this amendment it addresses the issue of potential civil liability for the manufacturing of personal protective equipment. We've been hearing a lot about these. We have a shortage of them in the state of Alaska, and healthcare providers are desperately in need of personal protective equipment, primarily masks in the state of Alaska, and there are small manufacturers and small businesses across the state of Alaska that would like to participate, but who are cautious of it, and healthcare providers are nervous about buying them because of the liability associated with that. And so we're essentially advancing this amendment, sort of calling it kind of a Good Samaritan amendment. It would ensure that civil liability protection if it's manufactured in good faith. Everybody's made the best effort to do a good job. It would require that the user using it, the purchaser and the user, would be informed that the PPE was not necessarily in compliance with federal guidelines, so they could make an informed decision for themselves about how to use it, whether to use it, and still allows for civil liability as a result of gross negligence, gross neglect, recklessness, or intentional misconduct. So I think it's practical. It came to us originally through the University of Alaska Anchorage's Center for Economic Development and the Business Enterprise Institute and the Alaska Manufacturing Enterprise Partnership, and we consulted with healthcare providers across the state, Providence, the ASHNA, Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, and ANTC. They would like us to advance this because they desperately need this, and they'd like Alaskans to be able to sort of step up to the cause, but to ensure that there's more PPE on the market.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would ask the maker of the motion, in lines 13 and 14, which are the negligence, gross negligence, recklessness, and intentional misconduct. My only caution with this amendment is that there's, the warnings notwithstanding, there's the possibility in that fine area between may not meet standards and gross negligence, there's defect.
Yeah.
And I want to know if it's your intent that defective masks would be considered. Is it your intent that if defective masks and the intent of this amendment would be covered under 13 and 14? And that is, to be clear, defective masks that while the attempt was made to meet to meet the conditions laid out, a mask that is defective could hurt somebody and would be a civil liability issue. So where's the fine line here? I just need to know that. It wasn't addressed, and I didn't. I just now have seen the amendment today, so I hope you might be able to address that.
Okay, we got everybody wants to talk. Chuck first, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Getting late.
It's late. So, in the public safety arena, the personal protective equipment that the officers and firefighters are issued, you're specifically warned that your latex gloves may be defective, that there is not a guarantee. They are mass produced. And in other words, they say visually inspect, and there's a reason why once you use them once, you dispose of them. It's not just because of the germs, but it's because they're certainly never to be used more than once. And they usually have a visual inspect label on them. So I think it's recognized in the industry, any protective covering over anything you can imagine is never guaranteed to be 100% without defect. I think it's standard.
I think it's good to get it on the record. Senator Bishop, you had something?
Yeah, I think that, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say, I used to teach this a long time ago for about 20 years, and just to put a point on this, if a manufacturer comes out with a new piece of respiratory protective equipment, it typically takes over 24 months to get it certified by NIOSH, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. We don't have 24 months. The second thing I'd like to say, people that are using this equipment are trained in this equipment, and they know if it's defective or not defective before they put it on because they're trained in how to fit test. So I just put that on the record.
Mr. Chairman, my question's been answered.
All right. And I'm just going to say this is our attempt to allow Alaskans to help Alaskans. There is a little bit of buyer beware and be alert. And so with that, I'll remove my objection. Is there a further objection to amendment number two? Without that conceptual amendment number two, then it passes. We have one other amendment. Representative Kopp.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment, conceptual amendment E.4.
We'll call that amendment number three. I'll object. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I refer members to section 23 of the bill, beginning on page 17, where it speaks of forbearance of state loans. This is under the definition of state. A conversation with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, they brought to our attention that, of course, they do make loans on behalf of the state of Alaska and could be included in this list as an exception of this word state, even because of the nature of those loans. And the two loans that they highlighted for us that they feel are outside of this are their home, their family residential mortgage loans, and their public housing assistance. They say that with those two programs, first of all, with the family residential mortgage loans, there's two issues there. One, that their interest goes ultimately towards a dividend to the state, and they wanted to stay away from anything that applied to investment assets. And secondly, they have federal regulations that apply to those loans as well, and the federal regulations also apply to the public housing assistance. So they said that they would like to be, for that reason, be listed as an exception to the normal meaning of state in this section because of those two specific loan programs that fall outside of the normal state loans, which were, as Julie Lucky pointed out for us, designed to be Alaska student loans, other revolving loans that were meant to be covered under the forbearance, but not necessarily these type of loans, family residential mortgage loans, and public housing assistance. So, did I get that right?
Not quite.
Okay,
let's get a little clarification. Yes. Senator Begich, I think you were in on this discussion.
I was, Mr. Chairman, actually, and I'm not one to correct the the rules chair of the
I get
House.
Corrected all the time.
I'll have bills that will come to him, but let me just, what this would actually do is, I apologize for that. For this, the on line 12 on page 18, it accepts A, B, C, D, and E in the current bill, which are different corporations. So the description of exception from the forbearance are those five. It would also accept from forbearance the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, but not include in that exception from this statute the single-family residential mortgage or the public housing assistance. Those would, in fact, be subject to forbearance, and that was the intent. It was that those two programs actually be subject to forbearance, but none of the commercial AHFC work would be subject. So it's the residential family residential mortgage loan or the public housing assistance, because there was concern that we could inadvertently put a hardship on residential mortgages and a hardship on public housing, and so that's what was intended. I apologize for having to
Mr. Chairman, Senator Begich, thank you. The late hour, I got it exactly backwards, and I'm glad that you were on top of it. Thank you, sir.
Representative Sponholz, you also, did you want to chime in on that?
I just wanted to point out that part of the reason that we wanted this amendment crafted in this specific way, and I just think it goes to the collaborative nature that was this conference committee, and I want to commend everybody and thank everybody for collaboration on this, that we wanted to make sure that we were allowing Alaska Housing Finance Corporation the flexibility that it needed to continue to do the investment work that it needs to do to effectively achieve its public mission. And we wanted to sort of carve out those residential mortgage loans, which, you know, HFC secures a bunch of those residential mortgage loans. My first one was secured by HFC, and the public housing assistance, which were are referenced in other sections of this bill. So thank you.
Further discussion? I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objection to this? With that, conceptual amendment number 3 then passes. That's all the – is there other amendments at this point? That brings us to the bill. Representative Kopp, I'd entertain a motion to move this along, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the free conference committee report for Senate Bill 241 from committee and recommend that the House and Senate adopt free conference committee substitute for Senate Bill 241 version 31-GS2260/G.
As amended.
G. As amended with the accompanying fiscal notes.
So the motion before the committee is to send the report to our respective bodies. Is there objection? Comment?
I want to object just to make a brief comment.
Yes, Representative Tallarico.
And I do appreciate, I appreciate everybody's work, and I know this is very necessary. And I may be the only one that have a little bit of anxiety. This is a big... There are a lot of moving parts in this bill, and I'm certainly more than happy to remove that objection unless someone else has something to say. But I do have a little bit of anxiety over, in particularly when we structure these moratoriums on residential utility services and evictions and foreclosures and things. I think another thing that we need to monitor and watch very closely, someone is on the end of the receiving end of these at some point, whether that be we've of course heard from landlords, and I think we've covered that really well and we understand that really well, but when it comes to utilities, there are providers there, and there's cost associated with generating power. The same thing with foreclosures. Someone's holding the note. It's part of someone's inventory. It's part of that package. So I have a little anxiety over it. And I guess, you know, I hate to use the expression keep my fingers crossed, but keep my fingers crossed. We're doing the right things, and that we're also doing the right things dealing with the pandemic that we have facing us, and that we get beyond this spike and this curve, and we see this as rapidly as it can go away. I think that's what we're all after, and trying to protect Alaska residents to do the same. I would like to mention, though, one more time, I think it's really critical, and I know that we really need to get the word out there. Trying to game this system is nothing to play with the stipulations that we have in this. I just want to remind anyone that might be listening, it's a very serious charge. Perjury is a very serious charge. I just want to say that one more time. It's very serious. It's Class B felony. It's, if you don't have a record, you certainly do not ever want that on your record at any point in time, and there can be serious ramifications. And I think we just need to make that very clear to everyone so that we don't have what's referred to sometimes as someone wanting to be a bad actor to come in and take advantage of this or anything, because that could be much more serious than I think a lot of people realize. But with that, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to put that on the record, and I will remove my objection. Thank you. Thank you.
Other discussion? Representative Sponholz?
Yeah, I just want to reference perhaps for Representative Tallarico's information the Section 20, one of the things that we did to provide some support to power companies, because if If Alaskans aren't able to pay their utility bills, that puts pressure on power companies. And one of the things that we did was we worked with the Alaska Power Association and with the RCA to allow power companies, if they have customers who are not able to pay their debt, to be able to book that debt as an asset on their books, and then with approval from the RCA to be able to recoup that cost. Because we also, and we also allowed them to collect power cost equalization money, even if their ratepayers individually wouldn't be able to pay for it, so that they would be able to keep, for rural energy providers who are particularly financially vulnerable, keeping the cash flow going is particularly important. And so we worked really hard to craft a compromise, I think, that would help to address some of those concerns. And I just wanted to, you know, put that on the record for people who might be watching, to know that we worked very hard to try to, you know, mitigate some of the challenges associated with pushing through a very, you know, broad-ranging measure in short order.
I want to thank the governor, the House, and the Senate, both, all three. This has been a work in progress. We're trying to figure out how to help Alaskans. This is a tough deal for all of us, everybody. Some people are hurting beyond what we can really understand, and we're trying to get relief without creating a tough situation where people are forced to do bad things. And so with that, is there any other discussion, Senator Bishop?
I just want to, again, to just throw that recognize the untold hours behind the scenes work of your office, these two young ladies here, our offices here. People don't realize they've been going on almost 24 hours now. It's appreciated.
It truly is. With that, I'm going to have the roll called at this point.
He removed his objection.
He removed his objection. So we can do a roll call vote?
We don't need one.
Yeah, we do. It's a conference committee, don't we? Oh, okay. Conference committee.
Yes.
Representative Sponholz.
Yes.
Representative Kopp.
Yes.
House, 3 yeas, 0 nays. Senator Begich.
Yes.
Senator Bishop.
Yes.
Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Senate, 3 yeas, 0 nays.
So with unanimous decision, the committee has passed this on to its respective bodies, and sign the report here in a minute. Thank you for all involved. Seeing no further business for the conference committee, we're adjourned.